Accession number 20456, Reel 9.
Brigadier Wilson, Reel 9. I was asking you about the organisation of the two headquarters in the 6th Brigade for the amphibious assault.
Yes. Basically, it was in a large brigade headquarters. We had a full colonel as second command. We had an enlarged signal section. We had two extra liaison officers. I can't remember how the clerical staff worked out, but basically speaking, it was designed for an advanced headquarters and a rear headquarters, which an ordinary infantry brigade is not.
What would be in the advanced headquarters?
Well, it rather depended on the brigadier. My particular brigadier reckoned his job was in the advanced headquarters, leaving the full colonel to look after the rear headquarters. And the when we loaded, the two headquarters were, I say the headquarters were on different ships in case one got sunk or damaged or arrested. And we kept that organization right up to the Battle of Kohima, and very well it served us there too.
Besides the brigade commander, who else would be in the advanced headquarters with him?
Well, he would probably have the G3, plus a couple of his liaison officer, plus his signal officer. We had two signal officers. And sufficient clerks and, you know, orderlies and people to pass the defense patrol. And the rear headquarters would have the remainder, but capable of taking over, you know, if anything went wrong.
Where would you be normally? Would you be with the advanced HQ or the rear HQ?
I varied according to the day of the week. It depended what the brigadier was feeling like. He said, I'll take you this time, you know. I suppose, having said that, I spent more time, I'm talking about you and I, with the rear headquarters. It just happened that way.
What were your main duties as brigade major? How did you see your role within the...
Well, of course, it's the best job in the army, or was then. First of all, you were the chief staff officer of the brigadier.
Did that mean that he effectively defined what you did, but you were more or less his...
Well, I mean, I was the guy. He'd tell me what he wanted me to do, or what he wanted done, and I was the guy to make quite certain that it happened. I was responsible for the discipline and running of the whole of the brigade headquarters. And that meant making quite certain that, you know, the right guys in the right place, if one was short of anything, one got it as soon as one could. It was an absolutely marvelous job.
What was your brigadier like as a man to work for?
I had two. The first one, John Shapland, was a regular gunner. He was a meticulous staff officer. He was a sweetie. I was very fond of him. He got very badly shot at Kohima. And he was replaced by an Australian called Bill Smith, who had been Indian Army. But when I say Indian Army, he'd been well, there's a sort of piratical units like the South Reserve, John Scots and so on. He loathed staff work. The further he could get away from generals, the happier he was. He was a wonderful leader. He could outthink the Japanese. If I would sum them up, one was a typical, brave, nice British soldier. The other was a typical, brave, very independent-minded Australian. Both absolute joys to work for, but both quite different in their temperament and how they went about things.
Presumably then you would have to adjust the way in which you were working
yes.
according to what the brigade commander was like. So what adjustments did you have to make when Chaplin was replaced by Bill Smith?
Well, Chaplin I knew. Chaplin, I think, did more to try than ever in staff college. Chaplin taught me the job of a staff officer, I think, which was to be able to translate a commander's wishes into a proper plan and make quite certain that the thing was coordinated, the clock worked, in other words, the various cogs worked.
You were concerned with the detail then of
I was execution. Concerned with the detail, but my goodness me, he kept a very strict eye on the detail.
Did you have to produce detailed written orders to serve the plans?
Oh, yes, frequently. Bill Smith was quite different. Bill Smith's idea was to fight the enemy. Knows paper. On one occasion, I said, get the orders, have them. Oh, he said there's no need for orders. And I said, well, I think there is. It's a bit complicated. We've got artillery and mortars and so on. I think we want to. Oh, they'll be all right. And I said, well, maybe they will. But he was, he was actually very grateful who got it all right for him. But it was against his whole paper he did not like.
Did Brigadier Chaplin have a notional routine working day?
No. He was much... He ended up as AQ in Rhine Army. I mean, he was a gunner. He was a very good gunner, but like a lot of gunners, he was meticulous. He had been, and he had been CRA of the division before he took over 6th Brigade.
Well, that would seem to indicate that he would have a methodical way of thinking and doing.
Very methodical. Very methodical. There he is. And I wouldn't say pernickety, that's not the right word, but detail mattered to him, it really did.
And it didn't matter so much to his successor?
No. Bill Smith's idea of commanding a brigade was to get as far forward as he could and see what was going on, do things. And whenever General John Grover wanted to, see Bill Smith, he was always sort of miles in the jungle, miles from anywhere. And on one occasion, he got hold of me and Bill Smith, and he said, I'm coming up to see 6th Brigade, make sure the brigadier is, there. And I got hold of William Mackenzie, who was rallying singular, and I said, do not let that brigadier escape in the jungle. Escape he did. John Grove appeared and said, where's the brigadier? And I said, oh, just here, sir. He wasn't very well there. So he and I had to have an eyeball confrontation. I said, sir, it's either your neck or mine. I was going to fight for it, but John Grove. And eventually he agreed. It was if he was, he'd been a bit naughty. But having been brought up in Wazeri style and places like that, he really did feel that he did much better. He didn't want generals sort of breathing down his neck. Luckily, he was a very great friend of Bill Sims. I mean, they're very friends. But of all the soldiers I've served under, I think Bill Smith was the most natural commander I've ever come across. And he knew, he had a sixth sense about him, that chap.
What were his talents? What are the talents of the good commander? Talents and qualities that are required?
Oh, I think to be able to first of all assess what has to be done and then be able to tell people quite simply how they're going to go about it and then see that they do it.
Are those matters that are produced by breathing, are they natural, do you think, a matter of temperament?
No.
Or are they produced by practice and education and training and experience?
No, I think the great idea that, you know, soldiers are bred is a very old-fashioned one. Monty would tell me, that really he wasn't awfully interested in soldiering to start with, but then he did. Once he got interested, he made damn certain he knew anything about it. Story of him, you see, they said, oh, Monty, a teetotal, you know, didn't like drink. Absolutely untrue. But he said, when he first joined his Royal Warwickshire Regiment in India before the First World War, it was customary every night to drink the sovereign's health in port, whether you liked it or not. And so he said, well, if I was going to be made to drink port, I was going to make damn certain I drank the very best port and the best value for money. So he said, I started reading up about port, and, you know, I became a sort of expert in my own way. And he said, if you're going to do a thing, for goodness sake, do it properly.
So it is then a matter of application.
Do it?
It is a matter of application.
Yes, that's it. And of course, the thing Monty could do was to get hold of an enormous document and reduce it to one sheet of paper, you know, which anyone could understand. I'm sure it's application. I think you... It comes out in so many books of the sort of great commanders and people. It comes out in Allenbrook, for example. But it's interesting, you know, sort of. Another interesting guy I served, you see, was Richard Gale. And yeah, Sir Richard. would like to give you the impression that he was the biggest bloody fool alive. In fact, was as clever as a bag full of monkeys. And on one occasion, one Saturday morning, I was sole duty staff officer in the military training directorate. This is in the War Office days. And a horrid green file arrived on my desk, which was a parliamentary question file, which had to be back answered the House of Commons by midday on Monday, so that the question could be answered that Monday afternoon. And it was all about some piddling little rifle range, now you shot. Yeah, I've got this. Oh, I know. And it was an enormous file, you know, a long time. And I sort of looked through it, and I thought, well, you know, here's the answer. Wrote a draft out and took it to the duty general. It happened to be Richard Gale. And he looked at it and he said, "Have you sent for the file?" And I said, "Well, there, sir, this is the parliamentary file." And he said, "But there's a file for everything here. Send for the file." And I said, "Well, it's Saturday morning and stuff." So he said, "Don't mind." He said, "I'll tell you what." He said, "You put in a special request for that file to be on your desk at 8:30 on Monday." And he said, "At 10 o'clock, you will, having looked through it, give me the answer, and we will see what we'll see." So I came in very early. A massive file was produced. It hadn't been seen for years. And it's last been minuted in 1939 by a certain R.N. Gale, Major GSO2, with a detailed answer. So I got hold of his answer and put it on the parliamentary file, went down there, and he grinned and he said, "You've got the file." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "I told you, didn't I?" And he said, "Yes," he said, "that's an excellent answer, I'll sign it." And he threw the bloody file at me and he said, "I've done your bloody work for you, haven't I?" that was Richard. I mean, Richard, he taught one a very good lesson, you know, that...
always go to your original sources.
Always go to the original thing, you see. He said, "Why bother to muck about?" He said, "All these people write vast papers and things. Most of it's all been done before."
So would you say then that the real art was reducing the complicated to the simple?
I'm sure that is.
If I can just go back to these two headquarters for a moment. When you were still planning to do an amphibious assault, presumably the advance headquarters would have arrived on the beach early during the operation.
Correct.
Yes. Where would the rear headquarters have been?
The rear headquarters would stay on the headquarters ship until the... you realise that in a task force, one ship is a headquarters ship, which is specially fitted out with communications, and very complicated communications, because it has got to keep its own ships under control. It's got to be able to talk to the admiral, and it's got to be able to talk to the army commander. And we had our headquarters ship was a lovely ship called Bulolo, she carried landing craft too. I mean, the question about it. She was trying to remember what line she was, Bulolo.
Was she a converted liner?
Yes, she was a converted liner. Converted liner.
What sort of facilities did you have on that ship besides the wireless networks? It seems to me you must have had at least three nets from that ship if you were going to the Admiral, to other ships, and then down to the troops ashore. So that's three. Yeah. Three wireless nets. What other facilities?
Well, of course, she had her own, first of all, she had her own signalers.
Yes.
That took over her own main nets. Mm. You manned, your signalers, manned the brigade command net.
Yes.
And the brigade command net stayed on the headquarters ship until the proper headquarters were set up ashore. Yeah. And then shut down and went ashore.
How many stations would there be on that net, the brigade net?
A brigade net would have your three battalions, gunner, sapper, field ambulance, and of course the rear link to division. Mm. And again, because Kmaidov's rear link to Bulolo herself. Mm. So it's quite an organisation.
Was there a sort of operations room set up?
Very much so, yes.
What was in the operations room? How was it laid out and furnished?
Well, it was just a jumble of wireless sets, really. Nothing. I mean, with a big sort of map thing that you could put on it. That was for the landing. The ship, of course, had her own operations room for her own purposes.
So you had a separate operations room for the military,
yes,
the army, and then there was another control centre for the ship itself.
Yes, but I mean they were side by side. I mean, yeah.
Could you move easily from one to the other then, your ops room to the ships?
Oh yes, certainly.
You said it had a mat thing. Would that have been a flat table or an easel of some sort with a mat board on it or wall maps?
If I remember right, it was a vertical mat board thing.
Yes.
And there were things for our photographs pinned on.
How would you mark the maps? Did you use talc and chronograph?
Chronograph. And it wasn't like these other things you see nowadays where you have a huge bit of glass with people sort of writing backwards on it.
Yes.
No, we didn't have anything like that. No.
You mentioned in your memoirs a visit from Mountbatten at some stage. Remember?
Yes, indeed. That was, I'm trying to remember when that was. Yes, it was after. It was after the that landing had been
cancelled,
because he had he had already sloshed the Japanese in the Arakan, which was where we were going to have done the landing in the first place, and it was just before Kohima. Yeah.
Do you remember what Mountbatten had to say to you, and what impression you got of him?
Oh, that's marvellous. Yeah. Never in my life have I had such a difficult job as to organise a Mountbatten visit. He spent four major visits with us, as it were. It took most of the day. You had five, I think. We had one to each battalion, one to the gunners, and then one to the remit. And in each battalion, first of all, they all had to be sort of out of sight of one another. He would meet all the officers. Then he would move on and he'd meet a series of NCOs and other guys who he would talk to personally. And then, big staging, the whole lot had to assemble around a soapbox, specially organized soapbox. And he'd get on that soapbox and he'd talk to us. And it was, I never had anything like it, because we had Welshers and ours, Dunwright Infantry, and Royal Barks, and Bucks Yeomanry. He said virtually the same things to each of the groups, but he said it with very subtle differences, so that they all thought, that he was talking specially to them. I've never had anything quite like it before. It was marvellous. I mean, as a morale raiser, this was out of this world.
Do you remember what the main points of the message were?
Yes, very well. He said, things up to now have gone pretty badly. We've been chucked out of here, there, and everywhere. But he said, you've got to look at this worldwide. He said, Americans are doing astonishing things in the Pacific. The Japanese naval power and our power is being broken. And then he turned to what was going on in the Arakan and how, for the first time, we had absolutely halted a Japanese offensive in its tracks. And he said the reason was better training, better medical supplies, better all sorts of things. And he said that the main forces of the Japanese had not yet come into battle in Wundu. And he said, when it did, we would have a part in it. But he said, forget combined ops. That's elsewhere. And it really was like a sort of holiday by the seaside. People sort of said, if only people would come and talk to us like that before.
Had no one done that before then? Was this the first time they'd seen a senior officer?
Well, no, you see, senior officers, Mountbatten was a very, very, very senior officer. He was, a supreme commander by then, and had the overview of what was going on in China. Why should we bother about supplying China? How did the visions of the Chinese tying down Japanese, that sort of thing. The sort of thing that no one had ever bothered to tell us about.
Do you think that the soldiers, the other ranks, were interested in that level of information?
Oh yes. They all went about, you know, walking about 2 foot higher, 2 feet higher. Well, they felt they were part of a proper team, you know.
How long did he spend with you doing this?
How long?
Yes, how long did he spend with you making these visits? And
well, I can't remember. I suppose he spent about 20 minutes with the officers.
Yes.
20 minutes with the selected guys. And probably 25-30, you know, talking to the boys and, you know. So you had a good 3 hours per major unit.
That's a considerable amount of time, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Did he arrive with a large retinue following him?
No, not really. But you see, he was bloody well briefed. I mean, came to me, I'd never met him before in my life. And he said, you were with the other Stuart in Malaya, weren't you? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, well, you'll be delighted to hear that he's coming out to join my staff as coordinator of training in jungle warfare. Mm-hmm. Well, now, okay, a fairly humble major to be addressed like that by a very, very senior commander-in-chief, does something, and that was the sort of thing he would do to people. Bloody good briefing by someone.
He must have had a very good memory too to
carry
that sort of information as he went from one.
Yes. Mind you, he had a bit of time, you know, between walking from one place to another and so on. Yeah.
What about other senior officers? How did they generally behave when they came on visits? Did they follow the same sort of pattern, or did
they weren't quite the same sort of people. Monty Stopford, our corps commander, was an absolute sweetie. He was a rifleman, but he was not a great chap was making speeches or anything else. John Grover, the general commander, everybody adored. But in some ways, I mean, they were following him to death, but in some ways, because he, I was talking to his son yesterday in London, the boys were a little bit scared of John Grover. Because when he got angry, he got very angry indeed, but in a very particular Wickhamist way. I mean, no filthy language. It was just you were made to reduce the feel about that high. Sir George Giffard, we hardly saw. He was the sort of senior general in India. Slim, of course, we saw later. We hadn't come across Slim by then. And Slim would twist anyone around his little finger.
He could talk to soldiers, couldn't he?
What?
He could talk to soldiers.
Oh, he was marvellous. He was out of this world. Wavell was the interesting one. I told you the story about Wavell. Well, Wavell, you see, had commanded 6th Brigade, the division, and then, of course, he was Viceroy of India. And after Kohima, he came along to hand out the ribbons of people who won decorations. And it was John Grover had finished with us then. It was Cam Nicholson who was the commander, was a great chap. And we produced for Wavell the same guard of honor that he would have had 15 years before when he commanded 6th Brigade,